This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Traitor's Ruin by Aaron Beatty. Read for you by Kathleen McInerney. To Kim, who didn't tell me how terrible that first draft was, making all this possible. Chapter 1. Knitting needles weren't very effective weapons, but they were better than fencing with feather quills. Sage lunged at her pupil, and the princess blocked her smoothly, but stopped short of where she ought to have finished the move. "No, no," said Sage. "Carry that around, and force my blade away so you can move in." She took a step back. "Let's try that again." "Do you mind?" snapped 11-year-old Corinthia from across the schoolroom. "I can't concentrate with combat knitting in the background." Princess Rose lowered her blade and rolled her eyes, but Sage gestured for her to stay quiet. "Sorry, Kara. How many problems do you have left?" "5. "That's good enough for today. You can go." The princess was out the door almost before Sage had finished speaking. "Would you like me to look over her paper for you, Sage?" Arithmetic was easy for Rose, but she'd also do anything to delay needlework. "No, thank you." Sage picked up the page and scanned it. 12 of the 15 finished were correct. Corinthia had made a lot of progress in the 9 months since Sage had become her tutor. "Are you going to the training yards this afternoon?" Rose asked, idly twirling her knitting needle. Sage tried to act like it hadn't been on her mind for hours as she nodded. "They're having a double ring fencing match today. Master Reed says I'm ready." A glance around the room told her it was tidy enough. She offered Rose the knitting needle she still held. "Don't forget this." The princess made a face before accepting it. Together, they walked into the adjacent room, where Rose's mother and sister sat working on an elaborate tapestry near the hearth fire. The queen was a fair-skinned northerner with bright, wheat-colored curls that Rose had inherited. Sitting by her side, Princess Kara was in her element at last, stitching scarlet designs into the heavy fabric. Rose groaned. Knitting she disliked, but embroidery she hated. Sage curtsied. "We're done for the day, Majesty," she said. "Is there anything else you need of me?" The queen was slightly farsighted, and Sage had taken on the additional duties as her private secretary a few months ago. "Any new correspondence?" "I suspect you are really asking if there is anything for you," the queen said. "But no, there is nothing." Sage frowned. This was the second week in a row there was nothing from Alex. As he was the king's nephew, and she was employed in the royal household, their private letters were often included in official dispatches going to and from the capital. More reliable delivery, but still sporadic. Orianna looked up from her sewing with a gentle smile. "The Tagan Pass has already opened for the year, so communication will increase in the next few weeks. If anything does arrive, rest assured I will forward it to you immediately." Sage wasn't sure when she'd stopped feeling awkward when members of the royal family showed such consideration for her feelings. "If there's nothing, then Your Majesty will excuse me." "May I go with her, Mother?" asked Rose. The queen's tone became more formal as she addressed her elder daughter. "Twice already this week you have skipped embroidery to watch Sage. Both times you promised to make up your work, and both times you have failed to do so."
"But, Mother..."
"The answer is no." Orianna squinted into the magnifying glass over the cloth. Close work and reading strained her eyes and gave her headaches, but sewing was something Her Majesty would not give up. "You need not ask again." Sage shrugged apologetically at the 13-year-old, but privately she was glad not to have an audience today. Rose stomped to her sewing basket and plopped down, slouching against the back of her chair. Orianna glared at her, and Rose immediately straightened. With a sigh, the queen sat back and rubbed her eyes, before looking up to Sage with a weary smile. You've gone down to the training yards every day this week, if I'm not mistaken. If it weren't for Captain Quinn, I'd think you had your eye on someone. Sage flushed. It helps me feel closer to him in a way. The conflict in Tazmit had started at the end of last spring and was now entering its ninth month. No amount of writing could make up for all the time they'd lost. I also enjoy it, and with all the new soldiers arriving lately, there's so much more I can learn. Orianna's expression clouded over. Yes, well, I'm sure you don't want to be late today. She turned back to her sewing and jabbed her needle into the fabric. The mood shift was puzzling, but Sage didn't have time to unravel it right now. She curtsied and departed the queen's sitting room, already mentally wielding a sword. She'd have to hurry if she wanted to claim one of the padded armor suits small enough to fit her slight frame. In her excitement, she'd taken 20 steps before she remembered she was still wearing a dress. Sage whirled around and trotted back in the direction of her room, loosening the laces of her bodice as she went. 5 minutes later, she was taking shortcuts through the servants' passages, dressed in breeches and a linen shirt. More soldiers than ever filled the yards, shouting greetings to old friends and making new ones. Sage wove through the crowds, focused on getting to the main arena. She'd long ago cured herself of automatically searching every group of soldiers for Alex's face, hoping against hope he'd return to Tenegal before he could tell her he was coming. She had been only partly honest with the queen. Coming here did help her feel closer to Alex, but her reasons went deeper. Ever since father died 5 years ago, Sage's life had been ruled by others. Her aunt and uncle may have had good intentions, but her guardians had set her on a path of relying on a husband for her safety and well-being. When she worked for the matchmaker, Darnessa was better at letting her have independence, and Sage might have found herself after a few years. But last spring changed everything. She'd never felt more helpless, more of a liability than she did at Tegan. Alex's soldiers had needed to get packets of red blaze, powders that created massive columns of red smoke when burned, to the scouts outside the fortress so they could signal for help. Sage was the only one who could squeeze out of the sewer grate to escape, but she was caught by a sentry. She'd been barely competent enough to defend herself, and it had almost cost her her life. She would never be helpless again. Sage managed to snag the last suit small enough to fit her, beating out a palace squire who had wasted time picking out a sword first. She tried not to look too triumphant as she shoved her arms into the sleeves and buckled the top half to the bottom. Even luckier, this particular outfit was designed to also wear on horseback, meaning the rear and back of the thighs were looser and not padded. Frankly, her backside needed the extra room. Once the practice armor was secure, Sage selected a training sword, opting for one heavier than squires normally worked with. She would tire quicker, but she'd learned the extra weight behind her swings somewhat compensated for her weaker arm strength. It also made her stronger. She pinned the sword between her knees as she tucked her sandy braid inside her helmet and lashed it down. Then she stood straight and hefted the weapon in her hand, trembling with sudden nervousness. Today, she would find out just how good she was. Chapter 2. Sage took a place in the inner circle of fighters, facing outward. A ring formed around them, matching up one to one. She saluted her first partner and took a guard stance, idly wondering if she knew the man. With the bulky and often misshapen padding, there were only 3 or 4 men she could positively identify once helmets were on, and one of them because he was missing an arm. It worked both ways, however. Due to her size, most assumed she was a squire, which suited Sage just fine. The regular guards had gotten used to her presence over the last few months, but with all the new soldiers lately, things tended to get awkward if they realized she was a woman. When the bell rang out, Sage and her opponent quickly fell into a rhythm of attacking and defending. As it was the first round, they both were more interested in warming up than scoring points. They lunged and blocked with increasing intensity until the bell signaled the end of the round after 7 minutes. Both lowered their swords and saluted each other again. Her partner took several steps to his right so another fighter could move in front of her. She saluted the new man and set her feet for the next round. After 4 rotations, Sage was sweating heavily under her armor, but feeling confident in her performance. A few fencers slid in or out of the formation, one pair inserting themselves 2 positions to her right. She didn't recognize either of them, but it felt like the one in the outer ring was watching her. Had he seen signs she was a girl? Hopefully not. As the man rotated closer, she watched him too. The scruff of a black beard showed under the padded helmet, so he was likely in his 20s at least. He was taller than her, but most men were. Well-built without being bulky, though the padding made him look slightly hunchbacked. And his sword. It was a standard practice weapon, not a personal one, yet he handled it like an extension of his arm, with swift and smooth efficiency. Not a movement was wasted. A clip across her shoulder reminded her to pay more attention to her current opponent. Sage shook sweat from her eyes and refocused on her own match. At the next bell, the man stepped before her. His helm exaggerated the movement of his head as he looked her up and down, assessing her, no doubt. Though she couldn't see anything, not even his bearded neck from this angle, when he saluted, she got the feeling he was smiling. He plainly did not see her as a challenge. Well, she would show him she was no novice. But in less than a minute, his superiority was obvious. Master Reed described her as advanced for her time and with promising grace of form, but her new opponent anticipated her every move and countered effortlessly. When he went on the offense, she could tell he moved slowly for her benefit. Part of her felt angry at being patronized. Another part was grateful he hadn't merely disarmed her in the first 3 seconds. After a time, she realized he was testing her, letting her show what she could do, and she began to appreciate him. Until she leaned too far to the right in a parry, his sword whipped around and smacked her rear end. Through the slit in the helm, she caught the glint of his teeth as he grinned. Rage flashed through her. He knew she was a girl. Why else would he have done that except to mock her? Nearly blind with fury, she recovered her balance and attacked, which he easily blocked. Sage shoved away and stepped back, and he shook his head in warning. She struck out wildly, but he knocked her sword to the ground and laid the flat of his blade across her backside again. Tears of humiliation blurred her vision. While she stood clenching her fists and trying to decide what to do, he retrieved her sword and offered it back to her. There was no sign of a smile behind the mask this time, and she understood. He'd warned her not to attack in anger and taught her a lesson when she didn't heed him. Humbled, she accepted her weapon and assumed the guard position. He nodded approvingly, and they began again. The bell clanged, ending the round, but the man gestured for the next fighter to go around. The other swordsman shrugged and moved past them. Her mysterious partner had taken an interest in her. Given his skill, it was somewhat puzzling. He gained nothing by staying. Then the bell rang again, and she dismissed her confusion to concentrate on the fight before her. After a few exchanges of blows, her partner stepped back and motioned for her to lower her blade. Cautiously, she did, and he shifted his sword to his left hand and approached to stand behind her. Without a word, he placed his hand on her wrist and corrected what she'd been doing, guiding her arm in a more efficient arc and slice. The man's directions were better for her height and arm strength than what she'd learned.
"Thank you," she said, the words echoing in her helm.
The man nodded and took up his position again. When he switched his sword back to his right hand, he flexed his left several times, like it was numb. Her eyes widened. No, it couldn't be. But the more she watched him, the more sure she became. When the round ended, once again her partner waved for the next fighter to skip them. The man at the bell called out that this would be the last round. Their sparring changed. Her opponent became aggressive, forcing her back almost constantly. He plainly intended to make her yield by the end, though she knew he could do it at any point. Winning this fight would require something other than skill. She waited until the right moment, then faltered. As she knew he would, the man took advantage of the opening, but she was ready to move into it. Making it look like he stabbed her, she collapsed with a cry. Her partner dropped his sword and dove to catch her. He rolled her onto her back and knelt over her, pushing her helmet off and feeling along her ribs. "Where?" he gasped. "Where are you hurt?" Sage grinned up at him.
"I'm fine, Captain, but you're dead."
She jabbed him in the stomach with the dull point of her practice sword, and he glanced down. Scrambling to take off his helm, he looked back at her with a mixture of pride and vexation in his brown eyes. "You're a cheater, you know that?"
"As I recall, you taught me to use every advantage I could."
Alex laughed. "So I did. I yield to my lady." All the padding made it difficult for him to kiss her, but he managed. Chapter 3 Captain Malcolm Hazar sat in the corner of the bustling tavern, nursing a pint of ale. It was a weak brew, but he endured it, as he endured everything in this country. The rough weave of his cloak hung around him, so only his forearms were exposed. From beneath the hood, his eyes tracked the movements of over 24 other customers, 3 barmaids, and the establishment's owner, a fat, greasy man who acted like he owned the barmaids as well, the one exception being a pretty girl with lips and nails painted to match the fiery tints in her hair. The barman gave her a wide berth. 2 silvery scars under his left ear were likely the reason. The redhead brought Hazar an ale to replace the one he'd finished. Before taking his empty mug, she traced a fingernail over the swirling tattoo on his bronze arm. "Don't get many Aristellans here," she said in a husky voice. She mistook him for an Eastern Demoran, but that was fine with him. Khemisar weren't welcome in Demora, even before the current conflict. Hazar allowed himself a vague smile. The door to the tavern opened, bringing a gust of frigid March air Hazar could feel even in this corner. Finally. "Another ale," he told her, "for my friend." She glanced over her shoulder at the man weaving through the crowd and turned back to the bar with a sigh. Hazar exhaled in relief. Pretty as she was, the less attention he drew from anyone, the better. The newcomer swept back his own cloak, made of a fine but sturdy cloth, with a Demoran royal crest on the collar, and joined Hazar at the table, bringing with him the strong scent of horse sweat and dung. He sat at an angle, so neither man's view of the room was obstructed. Unlike Hazar, he'd spent most of the winter indoors, and his southern complexion had lost some of its copper undertones. The arms he leaned on the table were also scrawny compared to the muscles Hazar displayed. "You are late," Hazar said in Demoran. He hadn't spoken his native tongue in over 9 months. Only a trace of his accent remained. He could even say Jovan, as the Demorans pronounced it, Chauvin.
My work has increased with all these arrivals, the stable hand said. Fortunately, also my pay. Riders tip well for extra care of their mounts.
He pushed a small bag of coins across the table.
Hazar pocketed the money with a grunt. As much as he moved around, he didn't have time to find steady employment, meaning every man he checked in with had to give him a small portion of his wages.
What news then? I have seen many soldiers arriving.
The other man nodded.
I hear rumors.
Hazar held up a finger as the barmaid returned with a full mug. The stable hand grinned up as she set it before him, but Hazar didn't dare look at her. Once she left, Hazar lowered his hand and waited for the man to elaborate.
They say the king will re-establish the Norsari.
Having delivered this incredible statement, the man took a smug drink, letting it sluice over the sides and down his chin. Hazar blinked as he tried to process the news. Demora's elite fighting unit had been disbanded over 20 years ago as a disarmament condition of the truce after Kimisara's last major campaign to reclaim the region of Tazmet. A weak and foolish move on the part of the Demoran king, but he'd been young and eager to be seen as a peacemaker at the time. The events of last year undoubtedly nullified the terms of the treaty, however. Hazar tapped the side of his mug, but otherwise held himself still.
I would not consider the fuss in Tazmet worth such action. Maybe only another year with the forces they have will be sufficient.
He was also surprised the Kimisar were still raiding Tazmet after all these months. But after 3 years of famine and blight, there was likely little to return home to.
It would seem the Demoran king expects more trouble.
Hazar had no knowledge of what his own nation planned, but given the state of Kimisara when he left last year, he doubted it had recovered enough to attempt an invasion. Only the alliance with the Demiran family had made last spring possible. The agreement had been distasteful from the start, but he'd followed orders. When it became obvious the Demoran duke had no intention of keeping to the terms, however, Hazar had ordered his men to abandon Tagan and return home. Unfortunately, a company of Kimisar had been stranded in Demora on the east side of the Catrix Mountains, and Hazar had made it his mission to find them. Once he did, he realized there were too few men to fight their way back, but too many to keep together for long. He'd ordered them to disperse into the Demoran countryside, find work, and lie low until the time was right to either escape or make a stand. To further throw the Demorans off, Hazar had taken a team to the border to make it look as though the group had crossed into Kasman. Perhaps none of it had worked as well as he'd thought.
Trouble? From where?
Kasman. There have been signs of an alliance between our people and theirs.
Hazar snorted. The Kimisar and Kasmuni had common roots, but they hated each other even more than Kimisara and Demora. More likely, the Demoran king was misinterpreting the trail Hazar had left going south, believing it was Kasmuni testing the border, as the Kimisar were known to do in the west. He stroked the stubble on his chin, wondering if this was a positive or negative development. That the Demorans were confused could be an advantage. But once there were Norsari, it was only a matter of time before he and his men were hunted down and wiped out. A Norsari unit would take weeks to train, though. Hazar probably had enough time to gather the 150 or so Kimisar scattered east and south of the capital and make a plan to get home. Information would be his primary asset until then. The captain turned his eyes back to the stable hand.
If there are to be Norsari, who will be the commander?
I have heard one name more than any other.
The man's grin displayed two missing teeth.
And it is one you will recognize.
A few minutes later, the stable hand left to return to his job at the palace. Hazar ordered a third pint and barely noticed when it was placed in front of him. He did, indeed, know the name.
Few in the city did not. But Hazar had special reason to know it. Captain Alexander Quinn. He'd long ago discovered the name of the lead soldier who escorted the women to the capital city for last summer's Concordium. In scraping together information in the past months, Hazar was able to paint a clear picture of what had happened at Tagan. Demirin had been outfoxed, and Quinn had taken over the entire fortress with only a handful of soldiers. It appeared the Demorin captain would have succeeded even if Hazar and his men had stayed. The plan and its execution had been that solid. Quinn had also personally killed the Duke. An enemy one could respect was far preferable to an ally without honor, and Hazar bore him no ill will. He only wished to go home. It now appeared he would have to go through Captain Quinn to get there. Chapter 4. From her seat within the giant willow tree, Sage watched Alex pace the garden path, pausing often to look in the direction he expected her to come from. She'd arrived several minutes before him, and loosely braided her bath-wet hair as she waited. Maybe it was cruel, but she wanted to watch him for a few minutes, remembering the way he moved, savoring his eagerness. It was only fair, really, since he must have been spying on her in the tilting yards for quite a while. He flexed his left hand as he walked, probably out of habit more than necessity now. It had taken weeks to recover full movement from the wound Alex had taken in the forearm at Tagan. He'd even admitted in his letters that he feared there was some minor permanent nerve damage. Alex wouldn't want to make her worry, though, and Sage was concerned it was worse than he said. She'd have to ask his best friend, Lieutenant Cassick, for his opinion. Sage nervously traced the silver-threaded designs on her dress. The blue brocade gown had cap sleeves and a neckline lower than she usually preferred, making her feel exposed. It was much too formal for a walk in the gardens, but everyone said it suited her coloring and played up her better features. Sage had actually come to like skirts in the past year. Well, perhaps like was too strong a word. She'd come to a greater appreciation of pretty clothes, even if she felt like a duck wearing swan feathers. As the edge of the sun dipped below the high walls, Alex went to sit on the bench, bouncing his knees impatiently. Sage decided she'd had enough and called his name. He jumped up and turned to squint into the thick, drooping branches behind him. Sage? I'm in here. Vaulting over the bench, he parted the curtain of leaves with his hands and leaned in. When he saw her, he scowled. How long have you been here? Sage hopped down from the low-hanging limb. Long enough. Oh, you are going to pay for that. He swooped inside the shelter of the tree and lifted her off her feet. She shrieked and flailed as he lowered her gently to the ground, then pinned her arms down so he could kiss her neck. Say you're sorry, he whispered, his breath in her ear hitting her like a lightning bolt she felt to her toes. I can't, she giggled. That would be a lie. How long did I wait there like a fool? An hour? Try 3 minutes, 5 at most. The longest 5 minutes of my life. You deserved it after that stunt you pulled in the yards. How long were you watching me there? 2 times in as many hours you defeat me with treachery. Alex released her wrists to bury one hand in her hair and slip the other around her waist. I'm marrying a criminal mastermind. I'm hardly... But he cut her off with his mouth on hers. Sage wrapped her arms around his neck and kissed him back. His hair was still wet, too, and smelled of evergreen soap, like the mountain forest in winter. He lifted his face to whisper, I've missed you so much, before kissing her again and again, each time seemingly different, with a separate memory of longing attached. She never wanted it to end.
but at last he leaned back to look at her, tracing his thumb over her lips.
"Sweet spirit,"
Alex said softly. "I'd forgotten how much I'd do for that smile." Sage pulled one hand back from his shoulder.
"You look well, though this will take some getting used to."
She ran her fingers over the scruff on his chin. For a second, he looked puzzled. Then he laughed.
"Would you believe I'd forgotten it was there? It was just easier to manage these last months. Warmer in the winter, too."
He studied her face.
"Do you like it?"
She pursed her lips.
"I'm not sure yet. It looks quite dashing, but I've only seen and imagined you clean-shaven, so it's a little startling. And a bit rough on my face."
"I'll get rid of it tomorrow."
"I can get used to it. Give me a couple days."
Alex shook his head.
"Nothing will come between me and my lady. Nothing that would cause her to deny my kisses, especially. Besides, I can always grow it back later."
"If you want." Sage shrugged, honestly not caring. "Who else came with you?"
"Cass and Graham for officers,"
Alex said, rubbing his face where she'd touched him. Lieutenants Cassick and Gramwell were two of his closest friends and had been with the escort group last year at Tegan,
plus 100 hand-picked fighters.
That was interesting, especially considering how many similar soldiers had been arriving in the past weeks. She took a deep breath. Now came the question she wasn't sure she wanted to hear answered.
"How long are you here?"
"Not sure yet. Several days at least."
"Not great, but not terrible.
Will you have many daily duties?"
Alex rolled lazily onto his side next to her and stroked her bare arm with one finger, raising goosebumps among the freckles and faint scars.
"Cass can handle most of them for me."
"Shame on you, Captain. That's an abuse of power."
"Rank has its privileges. Besides, he'll make captain soon, so he needs the practice."
"Where will you go from here?"
Alex gently tugged her sleeve down and kissed her exposed shoulder.
"Not sure about that either. I have a theory, but I won't know for a couple more days. We got here a little earlier than expected. Can't imagine what drove me to travel so fast."
"Did you come through Tegan?"
Even in the dim light, she could see his face, pale.
"Yes. Why?"
"I was just curious how much it had been rebuilt, after all the fires and such."
"I honestly don't know. We didn't stop."
The venom in his voice made her recoil a little.
"If it were up to me, I'd have burned the whole place down."
How could she have been so thoughtless? Sage turned his face up to hers, to find his eyes bright with tears.
"Alex, I'm sorry. I wasn't thinking."
He squeezed his eyes shut.
"It's all right. I'm sorry I snapped at you."
She searched for something better to talk about.
"So what's your theory about your assignment?"
Alex sighed.
"Sage, I've spent 9 months waiting for this night. Can we please talk about something besides the army?"
His eyes were still closed as she brought her mouth to his.
"I don't think we need to talk at all," she said.
Chapter 5. Moro Demirin held Charlie tight against him with one hand, a dagger in the other. Alex's brother, barely 9 years old, struggled vainly as his dark brown eyes begged forgiveness for being caught.
"No," Alex wanted to tell him. "You did everything right. This is happening because of my mistakes."
"Choose, Captain."
Demirin smiled as he brought the blade to Charlie's throat.
"Choose?"
From the back room, the bedchamber, stepped the Duke's guard captain, Geddes, dragging a battered and bloody Sage. She was too weak to struggle as Geddes pinned her against his chest, but she stared at Alex accusingly.
"You said you'd come for me,"
she spat. But you didn't.
I thought you were dead. He begged her to understand. I would have torn this tower down with my bare hands if I'd known you were here.
The hate in her gray eyes did not diminish as Geddes pulled out a knife and yanked her head back to lay the blade across her slender throat. The ratty-eared guard looked back to the Duke. Dimirin was still smiling. Choose, he said again.
Alex reached for his sword, but found nothing at his waist, instead striking his elbow on the stone wall next to his cot. A bolt of pain shot up his arm to his shoulder, waking him fully, before rendering his arm too numb to use. He tore at the blanket with the other hand and half fell, half rolled out of bed, then stumbled through the pitch darkness to the door and out into the cooler passage of the barracks. The light of the low torch burned his vision, and he squeezed his eyes shut as he gasped for air. When he was sure he wouldn't be sick, he pushed to his feet and felt along the wall to the outer door. The faint light from the approaching dawn was gentler on his eyes, and he wiped sweat and tears away as he sagged against a barrel of drinking water. It was a dream he'd had before, though not for several months. Breathe, he told himself. It wasn't real. But so much of it was. When he'd kicked his way into the window of Dimirin's private chamber that day at Tagan, it was the only place left she could have been. Alex had fully expected to be forced to choose between Sage and Charlie, and he'd had no idea how he would handle it. But only Charlie and the Duke were in those rooms, and Charlie had died. Dimirin had made a critical mistake that morning in sending Captain Geddes to imply Sage had been caught in her attempt to escape Tagan. Alex was meant to think she was being tortured, but instead, he'd assumed she'd been killed. For the first hour, he was too sick to do anything. By the time he and his soldiers realized she might not be dead, Alex had regained control of himself, and he was able to make a rational, though rushed, plan. Had Alex thought from the beginning she was alive, he might have charged in without thinking. Not might have, would have. Alex ran a hand through his damp hair, relieved that feeling had returned to his fingertips, and stood straight. His body pulsed with adrenaline as he strode back into the barracks. In his room, he quietly felt around for his boots and socks. Lieutenant Cassick stirred as Alex opened the door again to step out into the passage.
"Where are you going?"
his friend mumbled.
"I thought we had the morning off."
Normally, a day began with group exercises, but Alex had pushed the men with him hard to get to the capital early and felt they deserved rest.
"For a run," he answered. "It's almost dawn. Best time for it." "Crazy bastard."
Cass rolled into a sitting position and squinted at the torchlight slicing across the floor.
"Need company?"
Alex hesitated. He didn't want to wait the 10 minutes Cass would need to be ready.
"Catch me on my second lap?"
One circuit was a mile and a half. Cass rubbed his face.
"Yeah, second lap. Just make sure you actually wait for me." "Then don't be late."
Alex broke into a run as soon as he was outside again. By the time Cass joined him, all traces of the nightmare and fear were gone from Alex's face. At least, he hoped so. Chapter 6 Sage was to meet him after chapel day services so they could go for a ride in the hills above the city. Alex had brought his spare mount with him to Tenegal, intending to leave her behind for Sage. Knowing she'd be reluctant to accept such a gift, Alex planned to frame it as doing him a favor, which wasn't entirely inaccurate. Shadow had been his first horse, and Alex wasn't ready to give her up. But the weight of a fully armed soldier was a little much for the mare these days. She was perfect for Sage, however. Sage was wearing riding breeches and her father's old leather fowling jacket as she waited outside the barracks, chatting with a short, black-haired soldier. Her own hair glinted with sunlight as she shook her head and laughed. In his dream, she'd been angry, and Alex took a moment to soak her happiness in, replacing the false memory with what was real. Sage looked away from her conversation and caught him staring. The soldier she was talking to stood straight.
"It's been a long time, sir,"
Sergeant Ash Carter said, rendering a salute. Alex tried not to roll his eyes as he returned it. Ash could have been an officer himself, but he'd refused a commission in favor of supporting his half-brother, the Crown Prince.
"How've you been?"
"Not too bad,"
Alex answered.
"What brings you here?
I thought you were in Mondeley babysitting Rob."
When the conflict in Tazmit had become too risky, the prince was moved to serve in a safer region. Robert hadn't taken it well, and Ash had gone along to calm him down.
"You know how it is when something important needs to be done by someone expendable," Ash said, with a self-deprecating grin.
Born a year after the death of the first queen, Ash was illegitimate, but had all the authority and privileges of a royal. Alex was technically only the crown prince's cousin, but he considered Ash just as much family as Robert. They'd all stuck together through page and squire training. It was only in recent years their lives had begun to diverge. Alex and Robert had high-profile positions in the army, but Ash preferred to work in the background. Due to his invisible nature, he made an excellent spy. Had Alex not reassigned Ash to scout ahead and then taken his place as lead informant, things at Tegan would have been very different. Sage would have met and befriended the real Ash Carter, for one. At the thought, Alex glanced at Sage, feeling queasy. She met his eyes with concern written on her face, and he smiled back, though the nauseous feeling remained.
"So, were you called in, too?"
Alex asked his friend, keeping his voice low and trying to convey meaning with his tone. Ash was about Sage's height, and he had to tilt his head up to meet Alex's eyes.
"Yes." "Do you know why?"
His friend smiled slyly.
"Maybe." "Care to share what you know? And miss the look on your face tomorrow? Not a chance."
Alex rolled his eyes.
"I think I already know." "I really think you don't."
Ash's joking manner fell away.
"Something big is going on."
Alex glanced again at Sage, whose pale face was blank. She was listening, but pretending not to.
"I've spent the last months fighting in Tazmit. You think I don't know how big this conflict is?"
Ash shook his head.
"No, Alex. It's bigger."
"Bigger how?"
"No offense to Sage here, but big enough that I can't tell you until we're securely in the council chambers."
Ash winked at her.
"I'll leave you two to spend some time together. After tomorrow, you're going to be very busy."
Sage watched Ash go, her lips pursed. Alex slipped an arm around her waist and drew her close. Sweet spirit, she smelled good. Like lavender and sage and sunshine. She turned into him.
"I see you shaved," she said.
He bent his face down to kiss her.
"Feel for yourself."
"I dreamed about you last night," she whispered several seconds later.
Alex suppressed a shudder as he remembered his own dream.
"I hope I behaved myself."
"Hardly."
There were 644 days until Alex reached the age at which De Morin army officers could marry. 644 days. He still had to resist her. He sighed.
"Let's get going. It's going to rain in a few hours."
30 minutes later, they were riding up the hillside trail. Alex's thoughts vacillated between Ash's cryptic words and a question that had plagued him for months. He hardly spoke until they reached the spot he wanted and dismounted. Alex tied up the horses in the shade,
while Sage set out a blanket and a lunch she'd scrounged from the kitchens. She was studiously peeling an orange when he dropped down beside her and stretched out with a sigh. The restless night and morning run were catching up to him.
"Nice view, don't you think?"
he asked, gesturing to the spires and roofs of Tenegal spreading out below them. Beyond lay the Ten Valley, partially covered by rain clouds slowly drifting toward them. It would be only a couple hours before they'd have to head back to avoid getting wet. Sage didn't look up.
"Are you going to tell me what's bothering you?"
"Just wondering about tomorrow. Ash obviously knows something about my assignment, but he won't tell me."
"Hmm." She didn't sound convinced. "It's a bit strange talking to him, given, you know."
That she'd fallen in love with Alex while believing he was Ash Carter. When playing the close infiltration part normally reserved for Ash, Alex had gone as far as to tell her much of Ash's life story. He'd been as honest as he could in everything else, though. The sick feeling returned. Sage lowered the orange and looked at him with raised eyebrows.
"I knew it had to do with him. What is it, Alex?"
He wondered if her job with the matchmaker last year had sharpened her insight, or if she'd just always been this perceptive. She wouldn't let go until she worked it out of him either. Truth be told, he needed to hear her answer.
"Can I ask you something?" he said, brushing a speck of dust off her breeches to avoid meeting her eyes.
She placed her hand over his.
"Of course."
He took a deep breath.
"When you found out who I was, were you disappointed?"
"I was furious, or don't you remember me hitting you?"
Alex couldn't manage a smile.
"No, not because I lied. I meant because I wasn't Ash."
He threaded his fingers in hers, but still couldn't make himself look up.
"If I were really him, I could have given you the life of a princess. We could even be married by now."
"Yes, well, I suppose I've resigned myself to marrying the youngest and most decorated captain in the army," she teased. "I only get a national hero who writes letters promising to pull down the moon if it would make me smile. Poor me."
When he didn't respond, she tilted his chin up with her other hand, which still held the half-peeled orange. The light in her gray eyes went from playful to earnest.
"I'll admit, it's a very romantic idea to be loved by a prince," she said, her voice softening. "It probably kept me from seeing what should have been obvious. But no, I was never disappointed."
"Not even a bit?"
She cocked an eyebrow.
"Were you disappointed to learn I wasn't a highborn lady?"
Alex finally smiled a little.
"I was just relieved you wouldn't be getting married at the Concordium. Then I realized how much trouble I was in."
"Lots and lots of trouble."
She leaned down to kiss him, then sat back.
"Hungry?"
Alex took the orange from her hand and tossed it away before pulling her down beside him.
"Not remotely."
Chapter 7.
Alex walked slightly behind Sage as they returned to the palace, brushing his fingers against her hip more often than the natural swing of his arm should have caused him to. It was a good thing the weather made them return when it did. Otherwise, they'd still be on the hillside, trying desperately to resist doing something irreversible. Why couldn't he dream about that? When they reached the receiving courtyard, Sage suddenly squealed and ran across the gravel to a young woman climbing out of a carriage. The pair embraced and danced around each other for several seconds, laughing and chattering. Even in a simple traveling dress, with her mahogany curls bound in a single thick braid, Lady Claire Holloway was easy for Alex to recognize.
"When did you get to Tenegal?" Sage was asking when he caught up to them.
"Just now," said Claire, her shoulders drooping in exhaustion.
We rode through the night. She gestured to the stately man who'd helped her down from the coach. Papa was called by the king, and he said I could come along to visit you.
The man stepped forward, and Claire introduced him.
Papa, this is my friend I've told you so much about, Sage Fowler. Sage, this is my future father-in-law, Ambassador Lord Gramwell.
The ambassador's bronze mustache twitched with amusement as he kissed Sage's hand.
It's a pleasure to finally meet you, my dear. Your appearance is just as I expected.
Sage's already rosy cheeks darkened further. Between their ride and lying on the blanket with Alex, much of her sandy hair had come loose from its coils. Claire extended her free hand to Alex.
Captain Quinn, I didn't realize you would be here too.
I arrived yesterday, Lady Claire,
he answered, bringing her fingers to his lips.
Did the whole company come?
Claire stammered as he released her hand. She was blushing furiously. Alex grinned.
I came with Lieutenants Cassock and Gramwell, yes.
The two officers had been an easy choice.
I'll tell Gram you're here.
He nodded to the ambassador.
And you too, sir.
Lord Gramwell shook Alex's hand in greeting. His son had been one of Alex's lieutenants since the ambassador retired and brought his family back to Demora a few years ago. Someday, the younger Gramwell would also serve as an emissary, which was one reason Lady Claire lived with his parents now, learning the role she'd play as a diplomat's wife.
Come on, Sage said, tugging Claire toward the main doors. Let's let Her Majesty know you're here and get you settled.
Alex had a few duties he needed to attend to, so it was better that Sage went with her friend now.
See you after dinner, Sage?
He said hopefully.
Same place?
Sage paused, looking torn, but Claire answered for her.
Of course she will. We can catch up tomorrow, after I've had a chance to rest.
Alex thanked her, though he doubted Claire's willingness to part with Sage was completely unselfish. Cassock would end up covering most of Gramwell's duties, too, once the lieutenant knew his own betrothed was here. Ambassador Gramwell leaned down to kiss the top of Claire's head.
I can see you're in good hands. I have urgent business, so you must excuse me.
He nodded to Alex, catching his eyes with his own for a second.
I'll see you tomorrow, Captain.
Alex frowned at the man's back. First Ash, and now an ambassador. Everyone seemed to know more than he did. Chapter 8. The next morning, Sage woke later than usual and was struggling to tame her hair when Claire knocked on her door.
Late night? Her friend asked with a smirk. You look tired. You hush, Sage said. I know you and Luke were out just as late.
That was a gamble, but she knew she was right when Claire blushed. With her friend's help, Sage managed to get her hair braided and pinned in a few minutes. Together, they walked to the Queen's apartment, making plans for the next few weeks. Claire had no idea how long the ambassador intended to stay, but he'd acted as if he'd be in Tenegal through summer.
He retired rather young, didn't he? Sage asked.
Claire nodded.
Mama was in poor health, so he returned to Mundalee for her. I think he misses his work, though. He jumped at the chance to come down here.
Sage couldn't help but notice how attached Claire was to her future in-laws, referring to them as Mama and Papa, as Northerners call their parents. Considering how cruel Claire's actual father was, and that her mother made no real effort to shield her daughters from greed-driven matches, Sage was glad her friend had a real family at last, even if it had taken 16 years to find them. A servant ushered the pair into the Queen's dining room for a private breakfast. Her Majesty already sat at the cozy circular table, draped with a periwinkle cloth and laden with an ivy spray tea set.
though she'd greeted Claire warmly yesterday. Orianna had seemed somewhat irritated by her arrival, and Sage observed Her Majesty for the first few minutes, looking for signs she was still in a foul temper. The Queen seemed cheerful, however, even playfully commenting that Sage was supposed to rest on her day off, not roam the corridors until the wee hours of the morning. Little escaped her notice, apparently. Sage was relieved by Her Majesty's teasing. She'd been half expecting a lecture about last night. It had been too rainy for their usual spot in the gardens, so she and Alex had strolled the palace halls, hand in hand, enjoying several minutes of privacy in every secluded alcove they'd passed, and there had been many. Surely such behavior wasn't proper for a royal tutor. As much as Orianna didn't sound bothered by it, Sage had no intention of abusing that allowance. She and Alex would have to be a little more discreet. "I'm so glad you girls are here," the Queen said, holding on to both Sage's and Claire's hands after they'd recited the mealtime prayer to the spirit. "I need your help." Sage glanced at Claire. Her friend looked as bewildered as she felt.
"Of course, Your Majesty," said Claire. "Whatever we can do."
"Good." Orianna released their hands, sat back, and picked up her fork.
"Do you know why Captain Quinn is here, Sage?"
Sage shook her head, before shoving a forkful of eggs in her mouth, relieved the Queen had started eating right away so she could.
"Not other than he has a new assignment. Even he doesn't know."
The Queen nodded curtly and turned her blue-green eyes to Claire. "And do you know why Ambassador Gramwell has come to Tenegal?"
"No, Your Majesty. He said nothing to me."
There was a hard gleam in Orianna's eyes. "Then we all have the same problem. We're being left out of something significant." She gestured at the servant behind her, a young woman who was almost constantly at the Queen's side. "This is Meadow. Her brother, Bryony, attends the king as cupbearer." Sage knew who Bryony was, so that was said mostly for Claire's benefit. As royal cupbearer, he attended the king in all public functions, and most private ones. However, after catching him throwing knives with astonishing accuracy one morning in the training yards, Sage privately theorized the young man was, in fact, the king's bodyguard. She'd never heard him speak, though. It was rumored he had no tongue. The Queen continued. "For years they've kept me abreast in matters of state that the King does not bother to include me in. Though I rarely seek to interfere, I feel it's my duty to stay informed." She paused and arched a delicate eyebrow. "Would you like to know what they've heard about the King's current intentions?" Sage nodded, astonished by the Queen's casual admission of eavesdropping on very private royal conversations.
"Nothing."
Sage blinked.
"Nothing?"
Orianna shook her head.
"Not a word.
Bryony has been excluded from almost all His Majesty's meetings and councils." She leaned forward again, her food seemingly forgotten.
"But Ambassador Gramwell was immediately included on arrival. Today, Captain Quinn will be added."
The Queen's intentions were now obvious.
"You wish us to learn what we can through our connections," Sage said.
"Yes." Sage didn't know how to react, but Claire looked horrified. The Queen might think it was necessary to pry into the King's secrets, and if caught, she would likely be pardoned, but Sage and Claire had no such guarantee.
"Your Majesty, with so many others excluded, the secret must be dangerous," Sage said.
"As would be pursuing it," she silently added.
"You have hit on the reason why I must know what is going on, Sage," Orianna said, drawing her mouth into a tight line.
She suddenly looked much older than her 35 years. "When this new unit he's assembling marches, Nicholas is going with them." Prince Nicholas was 14
and trained with the palace guards as a squire, rather than with the regular army, as his older half-brothers had. As a consequence,